Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
One of the great puzzles of economic history is how, following the fall of the Roman Empire, a politically divided Europe that seemed to be economically backward for the bulk of the medieval era eventually rose to prominence and became the home of the Industrial Revolution. This mystery is all the more mysterious if one did a rough comparison of the surrounding civilizations, about the year 1000, give or take a century. For example, the Abbasid Caliphate, which dominated much of the Middle East and Northern Africa from the 8th century to the 13th, could rightly be called an empire and showed signs of being more economically and technologically advanced as late as the 1200s. So what happened? Why did Europe surge ahead to become the dominant superpower beginning in roughly the 16th or 17th centuries? Or conversely, what happened to Islamic civilization that caused it to stagnate and fall behind? We addressed this question last year with Professor Timur Kuran of Duke University, but barely scratched the surface of this topic. And so I thought I would revisit it with one of Timur's students and a scholar in his own right, Professor Jared Rubin of Chapman University in Orange, California. Jared is an assistant professor of economics and is the executive director of the Association for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Culture, or ASREC, to which I am a member. I'm interviewing Jared in part because of his scholarly knowledge, but I also want to know if I've been accepted to participate in ASREC's upcoming conference at Chapman University, which just so happens to be strategically located across the street from Bruxy's, home of the best waffle sandwiches and desserts in the Western Hemisphere. Jared is also the author of a number of articles on economic history and its relationship to religion, as well as a book manuscript in the works, tentatively entitled God, Power, and Printing, The Institutional Roots of Economic Success and Stagnation in the Middle East and Europe Until 1600. Jared is also a subscriber to our podcast Facebook page, proving that good things come to those who like us. So please take a moment to connect with our free educational service by clicking on the Facebook icon on the right-hand side of our webpage, and please do tell your friends about us. Jared, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be here.
Hey, so I got two really important questions for you. First, did you get my proposal for the ASREC conference in 2012? And second, did you have lunch at Bruxy's today?
Of course we did get your proposal. It was very, very well done, and you will be at ASREC 2012.
Oh, good. I don't have to wait for the I don't have to wait for the email. I have to know, though, was it one of the more entertaining proposals you've received?
It was.
Okay.
Arguably the most entertaining. we're hoping that the presentation goes by that. Yeah, and it should be a great conference, if I can give a quick plug for that. ASREC.org is our website, and it's going to be an excellent conference this year, right here at Chapman.
Okay, we'll make sure that we link to ASREC.org, as I mentioned again. I am the member of that, and one of your colleagues, Larry Iannacone, was the key founder in the religion and economics movement and really helped to give the oomph to this organization. So
indeed, and now I hadn't thought about this before, but now that you mention it, maybe we can set up a big ASREC lunch at Bruxy's.
No, yes, absolutely. And people might be wondering if Bruxy's paid me to do that, and they haven't, but I'm hoping that they are listening to this podcast and then will pay me for all that free advertising. So, no, I just love the waffle sandwiches so much, I just had to mention it because it's great. I had a great time at Chapman a few months ago and had some good food down there. Okay, let's go ahead and get into the scholarly stuff. A great deal of your research agenda has been looking at the long economic history of Europe and the Middle East. We're talking over centuries here. And then trying to figure out why Christian Europe went one direction and the Islamic world did not. It didn't necessarily go in the opposite direction, but it certainly did not catch up or keep up with Europe. Now, I should note that your working book title, and I mention this because of what I just said here, uses the term stagnation rather than failure, implying that it wasn't the case that the Middle East didn't go backwards economically, but rather it really wasn't able to keep pace. Is that right?
Definitely. This is something that this has kind of become in vogue amongst economic historians to view the ascent of Europe as an ascent rather than a failure. And I think that's broadly right. It's not just the Middle East, but China and India had been kind of, as well as Europe, had been growing at a very, very, very slow pace for even millennia. And then you see, if you look at kind of this world GDP from centuries prior to Christ until now, it's flat, 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 then a sharp move up in Europe right around the Industrial Revolution. So it's hard to say that the other places, in Middle East, China, India, were doing something wrong necessarily. It's what happened in Europe. And then, the question then also, of course, becomes, why Europe? And that's what this research tries to answer.
Yeah, so we're really kind of talking about the norm of being a rather flat or stagnant GDP growth throughout history. A question on that, how do we know historically what the GDP rate was, say, in the year 512 or something?
So the further back you go, of course, the cruder the measures of GDP. There's kind of certain things such as how many cathedrals a town had that we can still somewhat tell in the basest forms of records. We don't really know, of course, on a year to year basis, and this is one of the things that more people are kind of turning to in economic history, is trying to come up with better estimates for basic things. So the big thing that most historians look at is population size, which we do have better. We don't know, there weren't censuses during this period, but we have better estimates for population size than anything else. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, really where you saw big populations is where there was wealth.
Right. Yeah, that tends to make sense. And, human beings have been pretty good record keepers of who is born and who dies, and governments have an incentive to do that for tax purposes. So
absolutely.
You would figure that.
That's the best records we have.
Yeah. Okay. But even though we don't have the greatest empirical sense of what exactly the GDP growth rates were, we do have the sense that it's relatively flat in across most of the world, and then all of a sudden it really starts to peak in, the 1600s or 1700s, depending on how you want to date it and look at the data in Europe. Well, let's go back to, let's say, circa the 11th century, so the year 1000 or so, and give us a sense of what the two worlds that we're interested here today, Christian Europe and the Islamic Middle East and North Africa, what did those things look like?
So Europe, there's the idea of the Dark Ages, where, which is probably an oversimplification of what was going on in Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire. Europe certainly did split and became a lot more decentralized. The main kind of thing moving, or the main connecting thing from the Roman Empire into what we'd call the later Middle Ages, was the church. The church was the only centralized organization, but the economies were very feudal. They were very extremely decentralized, and in between feudal areas, there was a lot of lawlessness. There were no large political units. We definitely know that. And the more important thing, I think, when we're thinking about the economies is, It was in many ways a scientific, economic, and technological backwater relative to the Middle East. We know that the Middle East was definitely far ahead scientifically with engineering, mathematics. This is where all the works from the Greeks came from. They were refound by Middle Easterners, not Europeans. And politically, the Middle East was, at this time at least, more cohesive, mainly as the Abbasid Caliphate, but there were other larger political entities as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to say that the Abbasid Caliphate was all-encompassing is a little bit difficult to say, largely because in the year 1000, it's very difficult to communicate from one end of the empire, one end of the caliphate to the other, so you do have broken down. It's the same thing, too. We talk about Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, you get something known as the Holy Roman Empire, But, you know, that really wasn't that cohesive of a unit, right?
No, not even, so not even into the 19th, or the, I guess it fell in the around Napoleon, but prior to right. that even, it wasn't cohesive. So there was kind of always a Holy Roman Emperor, you know, starting with the Franks, really, and Charlemagne, and kind of for the next 1,000 years, there was always an emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, but it was really just a series of decentralized fiefdoms.
Yeah, and the Holy Roman Emperor, pretty much name only, kind of a ruler. You mentioned this before that we talked about the Dark Ages, and you briefly touched on this, that we tend to think of the Dark Ages as Europe going backwards, but sure. Rod Stark and a few other historians have said that it really wasn't the case. It wasn't as if we got dumber or stupider in Europe. Sure. It's just things slowed down. What's your take on that?
This is kind of this, in a sense, revisionist history that's happened in the last couple decades. And there's a lot to be said for these new ideas, in a sense that primary idea of this being, you know, a lot of the advances made in this period were just not recorded. I think that a lot of the evidence that has been presented for this is convincing. On the other hand, kind of in the type of stuff I'm looking at in this research, it is quite clear that even if we are underestimating what was going on in Europe at this period, say at the year 1000, it wasn't even close economically to Europe. I mean, even if you look at the biggest economic centers of continental Europe, it was actually in Muslim Spain. You know, Cordoba, Sevilla were the biggest cities in continental Europe. You know, so it was clearly a period where, you know, if you put an alien down in the year 1000 and asked him which area of the world would have an industrial revolution, it definitely wouldn't have been Europe, and probably actually would have been China, but it certainly would have been the Middle East prior to Europe.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and talk about what happens over the course of several centuries here, from, you know, roughly the 800s to, you know, 1600, 1700. The Industrial Revolution is really credited getting started in the late 1700s, early 1800s, but I think some people also note that a lot of the changes that were taking place that gave rise to it were occurring a century or two earlier. So go ahead, and before we get into your explanation, focusing on religious factors and relationship between church and state, or religious authorities and political authorities, how have other scholars explained the rise of Europe?
Sure. So this is something that's been in, at least the explanations that have been in vogue, say, in the last couple decades, particularly with the work of Douglas North amongst economic historians, and Avner Greif, Duran Acemoglu, and his co-authors, is looking at the institutions that arose in Europe, really starting in the late medieval period. The questions that have been asked are, how does long-distance trade arise when you don't have large political units? That's really the work of Greif, as well as North, North and Thomas. And it's also about institutions that protect property rights. And this has been something that has been shown to be particularly important, especially in Europe, especially in England, for kind of the push forward that underlied the Industrial Revolution. But this, as you just noted, is something that goes back well prior to the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, as I kind of point out, and as well as, you know, a few others, such as, you know, especially Timur Kuran, you know, these are largely, with I think the work of Greif being an exception, Eurocentric views, kind of just looking at why Europe pushed ahead with, you know, and to some extent that is part of the answer, of course, but that it's only part, because you do have a nice kind of cohesive theory would also include, well, you know, why didn't these types of property rights that Douglas North talks about all the time arise in the Middle East?
Yeah, that you do a really nice job of flipping the question. So if, you know, both you and Timur Kuran is, well, not just why not Europe, but why didn't this happen in the Middle East? Before we go there, though, I wanted you to dip a little bit more into this issue of trade and property rights, because when one thinks of the Middle East, you think of merchant traders, you know, people either sailing the Mediterranean or making their way across large expanses of territory to sell their wares and things. Sure. And nowadays we think about the critical importance of government and being able to secure a lot of these trade routes and Europe, again, fragmented mess in the 800s. How could this stuff ever arise there? Greif's, you know, kind of big argument here that, you know, you wouldn't expect necessarily to see long distance trade relations and secure property rights arising in Europe where you don't have a whole lot of centralized political authority.
So you bring up, there's two interesting things you bring up there. One is that, you know, you do have a more cohesive political unit within the Middle East and North Africa. And this really does help facilitate trade in the sense that, you know, there's certain protections that are there for long distance traders that just aren't there in large swaths of Europe. On the other hand, one thing that is kind of, I guess, in a sense, underreported, or at least in the history books, when we talk about, you know, the long-distance merchant caravans traveling, you know, across the Sahara and into the Middle East, are that these were very tight merchant networks that were trading. And this is, you know, what economists call personal exchange, meaning, you know, these guys knew each other, right? You knew that if you sent your wares to somebody else, you knew exactly who that was. And it made it, you know, in the short run, or in a time when there's not a whole lot of economic activity, this is fine, because, you know, it's a small group of guys doing this. The big thing that emerges in Europe, though, which I think one of Avner Greif's main contributions to this is this argument, is that it's impersonal exchange that arises in Europe, and this is kind of what we're more familiar with today, in that you don't necessarily have to know the person on the other side of the exchange to do business with them. And that's an incredibly important part of, you know, the worldwide business that we think of today. And this is something that emerges in Europe well before it does in the Middle East, despite the fact that the Middle East did have this big advantage early on with these merchant caravans and their networks.
And that's one of the things that always surprises my students when I ask them about the difference between personal exchange and impersonal exchange. You always think, well, personal exchange is going to be much better because you know the folks. They're in your tribe or your clan. They're related to you somehow, and you know them very well. But again, that tends to be a rather narrowing type of network, that you don't travel beyond that network very much. Whereas impersonal exchange, you know, you think today with the internet, I, you know, plug onto some website who, you know, could be in Bangladesh or Florida and, you know, type in something and you get your product. Those impersonal networks really expand the amount of trade that can occur, allowing for, you know, the classic Smith argument of specialization.
Definitely. That I think is one of the kind of these nice insights that we can get by kind of comparing the two regions, is just to see, because it gives an even greater idea just how important impersonal exchange is when you see what happens to a region that doesn't cultivate impersonal exchange, or at least to the level that it happens in Europe. This is, of course, an oversimplification. This is not to say that impersonal exchange never happened in the Middle East and North Africa, but it certainly happened by the time of the later medieval period to a lesser extent than Europe.
Right, yeah, it's all about marginal changes and how that can affect everything. One of the things that we note about a lot of the previous research that has been done on the explosion of Europe economically and movement toward the Industrial Revolution is that it tends to ignore religious variables. And I'm wondering if you could say something about that. Why do you think that a lot of economists, you know, forgot this thing called the church? That happened to be kind of a big thing there, but they overlooked that for things like discussion about technological innovation that occurs and the role of universities and such.
I think there's a few reasons behind that, and not to speak for the entire profession, but I think some economists are scared to invoke not just religion, but kind of more cultural type explanations, just because they're very hard to measure. And economists certainly like things they can measure. That's a kind of a simplistic explanation. And I think the other explanation, which is probably more kind to my profession in a sense, is that there certainly, you know, there are other important things going on here. And the reason that they've been focused on, such as, you know, trade patterns, things like this, is that they're measurable.
Yeah.
And what it takes, and what it really took was, you know, somebody bringing in, and not myself, some, you know, people like Greif, bringing in more kind of game theoretic aspects into economic history, because when you don't have something that's measurable, you can still think about it, you know, through, you know, and economists do like models, but it does help clarify our thinking in a way. And this is something that I think kind of took certain advances to really be able to incorporate religion into our discussion of this. So I don't blame the older economic historians for not focusing on this as much, but on religion and culture as much. But I think it's something that, in, you know, as you may well know, this is something that is being looked at a lot more now over the last decade or two, just the role of religion in general.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you're right. We need to be fair to the older economic historians. The easiest critique you can make of anybody in academia is to find something they didn't look at and say, why not? And,
right.
You know, we can't possibly understand everything. So our knowledge keeps a pace bit by bit by bit, and people add some of this stuff on. As you noticed, in the last 20 or so years, with the, you know, big help of Larry Iannacone, one of your colleagues there at Chapman, as well as other folks like Rod Stark and Roger Finke, they've really brought the economic way of thinking into a lot of this. And so economists have been introduced to the issues of religion and what importance it might play for economic consequences. Let me just ask you this kind of on a personal level. How did you stumble into this? You're a fairly newly minted PhD, or you're assistant professor still, so you've been around for a while at Chapman and a few other places, but how did you stumble into this?
Well, so this guy we've been talking about, Avner Greif, was my dissertation advisor at Stanford University, and I actually didn't know that I wanted to be a kind of an economic historian or economist of religion at all until I took his class on institutions. And he's written a couple papers looking at kind of at different cultural differences, more specific on Islam and Christianity, and looking at how that has affected economic outcomes. And religion's always been something I've been absolutely fascinated in. I did a minor just for fun in my undergrad days in religion, and I never really realized until taking the class that this was something that economists even looked at. It was just something I thought I'd always read on the side. But then once I found out that that was the case, I almost immediately changed my intended career path, and it's kind of just gone from there.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience. I never would have put the two together, but, you know, just by accident, you stumble into, you know, either a class, or for me, it was discovering one of Larry's old articles, which actually was new at the time when I discovered it. And so you're like, wow, this stuff really connects, and people haven't done it. So it's been quite fun. So let's go ahead and dive into your thoughts on this whole topic. Now, it should be noted you're working on a book manuscript, so you have a lot of different ideas and things that factor into this divergence between Europe and the Islamic civilization. But I really want to focus on a paper that you published recently in the Economic Journal, where you emphasize the role of state dependence on religious legitimation. They have to rely upon religious authorities for legitimacy. And then how that interacts with various economic functions that are regulated by both religious and state authorities. And in that paper, you put an emphasis on financial lending and interest. And let's talk about that empirical focus here first. The issue that oftentimes comes up is prohibitions on interest or prohibitions on usury. And so to start this off, I want you, as an economist, to explain why interest is such a important feature of the economy. A lot of my students don't understand this, and I have to go back and explain that to them. And, you know, now as we speak here in early November of 2011, there's a lot of students occupying various Wall Streets and town squares around the country, and they're decrying banks for their greediness and their usurious interest rates. And, you know, this is something you've heard throughout history here. So, you know, some of my students are even claiming that in my political economy class, they've argued that the world would be a much better place without banks charging interest. So what's the big deal about interest?
Well, actually, if you let me, Will, this is an interesting kind of thing where history really does shed a lot of light on this. So kind of way back, if you go back prior to, you know, just take Europe, for example, the commercial revolution, which starts in around 1000 and, you know, maybe even, so even during the late Roman Empire, where you have most of the world, and even after then, is agrarian. So most loans that are being taken out are for consumption or to make sure that you have just enough food, you know, so you get to next year's harvest. In these type of circumstances, when you're talking about primarily consumption loans, really high interest rates are the market rate because people, you know, often need these loans. So the demand for loans is really high. And this causes a lot of problems in society because essentially what happens, and this happened both in the Middle East, it happened in Europe as well, is you default once or you even have to take a loan out once and you're in debt for life. And this is kind of the reason for the origin of, you know, these religious prescriptions on interest and restrictions on interest, because they did have great social consequences. The interesting thing that that I point out, I'm not the first person to point out in my research, is that you see something changing, however, when commerce really starts to become viable. When commerce starts to become viable, now consumption loans are not the only reason people take out loans. They also take out loans to start a business or maybe to, you know, as far as, you know, if you're a merchant, you know, to maybe just get some more goods so then you can then trade them and, you know, it's beneficial for everyone. And for these people, they're just willing to pay the interest because they know they can make a lot more out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you essentially get here is, without interest, people aren't going to be willing to lend to these people. And this is clearly something that lubricates the economy. In fact, there's a famous historian of the Middle Ages, Robert Lopez, that uses that term, that the interest is the lubrication for the economy of the commercial revolution. This, and for this very reason, and this is even much more so the case today when you're talking about these differences. Now, another thing that, you know, you use this term both usury and interest. Back historically, usury and interest were the same thing. Usury meant any loan at interest. Today, they mean different things.
And is that part because predominantly when we started thinking about interest a long, long time ago, we were dealing largely with these consumption loans, and so they just seem desperate, taking advantage of desperate people.
I think so, for the most part. That's my reading of the history. Yeah, and then what you really start to see changing, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but, you know, my paper kind of documents these changes over time, both mainly in Europe, because this is where most of the changes are happening. How, when you get commerce as being something that's very viable, you eventually, in the long run, start to see changes occurring in the types of transactions that use interest, and you eventually do see a difference in the way interest and usury are defined. And now usury is just very high interest, which most countries still do regulate, and in the U.S. it's mainly at a state level, because it's for similar reasons that today it's consumption loans, you know, even like payday loans, things like that,
or even credit cards.
That can go up to, you know, 30, 40, even much higher than that percent. And that's where you see the government actually having an incentive, in a sense, to try to eliminate those. The idea of eliminating lending at all is frankly something from, you know, millennia ago, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, again, one can kind of understand it and, you know, how this lingers on the thoughts of it, because we hear those terms usury, we hear prohibitions on usury, and
sure,
we think interest rates, you know. Yeah, surely the 40% rate on a credit card, you get upset with that. But, you know, hey, 8% or something on a house, well, I don't, you know, 8% might seem high, but, you know, we're down in 3% range. But, yeah, that still seems usurious to me. I just want people to give me stuff.
It's one of these things that you get to the point where you're talking about investment loans, whether they be, you know, an investment or even a house or something, and that's clearly in this range where it's a mutually beneficial and, you know, something that neither party is being forced into taking.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk about prohibitions against
interest or usury, as they were kind of blended back in the day. And talk about this through the Abrahamic religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And actually, let's just put aside Judaism because we're focused really on Christian Europe versus the Islamic Middle East, Northern Africa. How did these two faith traditions deal with prohibitions on interest or usury? What kind of laws or regulations did they have in place?
Well, in a sense, so in Islam, it's always been banned, taking interest on loans. This is something that's in the Quran. In Christianity, it was something that there are Old Testament prescriptions, the one in Deuteronomy being probably the most famous, but it was not officially banned until the Council of Nicaea in 325, where there was a prohibition on interest put forth. In the Islamic world, though, and this varies over different areas because Islam is a much more decentralized religion than Christianity, but broadly what you see in different areas is very quickly after Islam spreads are evasions of interest restrictions. So an easy one is what's called a double sale, where, you know, we'll go in the back room and I'll sell you my phone for $100 and you buy it back for me for $110 payable in a year.
Mm-hmm.
Like a 10% loaded interest, but it is actually two sales.
Yeah.
So legally it is confirmed. And this is something that was allowed. And what you actually see is, you know, there were much more complicated ruses around the interest restrictions than this, because that's something where that is only what I just suggested was only legal if you actually could value that phone at $100.
Right.
You know, so for big things, you know, you couldn't, for big loans, you really couldn't do this, because you had to have more or less the ability to give a full down payment. But there were much more complicated ways of getting around this that could construe loans in other types of transactions. And you see this eventually happening in Europe, too. There are a whole host of ways of getting around interest restrictions that start emerging. And in Europe, you really only start to see them once commerce, not surprisingly, once commerce starts to arise in around the late 10th and early 11th century.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that you just noted was that Islam tends to be a much more decentralized religion. There is no single pope or hierarchy. It's much more fragmented. And, you know, that combines with this issue of, well, you know, interest is going to be charged. How difficult is it to monitor and enforce prohibitions on usury and interest? And it seems to be pretty difficult. You have some, you know, as you mentioned, this double sale and a few other techniques they have of getting around this thing. But the Catholic Church in Europe, it's much more centralized. And at the time of the 700s, the 800s, the 900s, it in essence is the one bit of glue that tends to hold Europe together. And it also acts in many ways as a financial bank during this period of time. And folks like Eklund and his colleagues have written about how the Catholic Church has used usury doctrine to its advantage. So speak a little bit to that.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess you could say that even though Europe had ecclesiastical courts, in most cases, and actually in both Europe and the Middle East, these, to the extent that anything would have been enforced in more secular courts. And in the Middle East, there is plenty of documentation that the big thing that was done is and remember, in the Middle East, these are mainly religious, they are religious courts in a sense. You know, the religious jurists are also the judges. If you were found kind of doing something that was too obvious of a loan at interest, even if you tried to hide it, but you really didn't, say, use a legitimate way of getting around the interest restriction, the big thing that would happen is your transaction would be voided. And, you know, even the threat of that, and this is kind of across the spectrum here, and the threat of that certainly, you know, is enough of a stick to prevent, you know, at least big transactions from occurring with at straightforward interest. And in Europe, you know, you do have the church, you know, very vividly making anti-usury proclamations, you know, and this is also seen in the art of the medieval period. You have pictures of, I think it's the something like the rapist, the robber, and the usurer that are together. So these were things that it was much more in the kind of the imagery, and also there were, you know, just social pressures against users, you know, for a large part, this is one of the reasons why the Jewish population ended up being amongst the biggest money lenders in Christian Europe for most of the medieval period.
They could step outside of it, and I don't think the usury prescriptions that they had actually applied to non-Jews.
They did not. That's the Deuteronomy prescription, that it's only cannot lend it interest to a brother,
right,
and a fellow Jew. So yeah, so these are in a sense the ways that these were regulated. And you know, something I bring up in my paper though in my book as well, is that what you do start seeing is once commerce starts really emerging in Europe, all of the secular leaders, you know, the princes, the kings, the local leaders, do start having new types of usury laws, and this is one of the first times we really start to see overt usury laws. But these are usury laws, unlike the religious usury laws, they're more like the ones we see today, where they're interest rate caps.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how, and this is what was enforced. This is what ended up being enforced, starting not that long after the rise of commerce in Europe, or interest rate caps.
And this is by secular rulers, as you said.
This is by secular rulers. This is not something that was generally brought to ecclesiastical court. Ecclesiastical court was not really dealing that much with merchants.
Mm-hmm. And what about time frame are we talking about here?
So when I'm talking about kind of the rise of commerce, I'm really thinking, it starts in the late 10th and early 11th century, but it really starts getting into gear around 1100-1200 in Europe.
And this is when we start seeing a shift, too, between the power of the church versus the power of secular authorities, I think.
Yeah, so this is, you know, I think we might get to this, but this is kind of something that I say, you know, it's not coincidental,
right,
that these two are kind of moving in the same direction at the same time.
Well, before we get to that explanation of why this shift happens and why these things are happening at the same time, and the relationship between religious authority and political authority, it's, I think, really the hallmark of your argument. How did just these changes in interest rate policies affect the trajectories of the Middle East, of Islamic civilization versus Europe? I mean, why did this have an effect?
So this is something that I think requires a little bit of subtlety in the argument. I do have another work on this that shows one way in which this happened. So, I mean, the general idea is that, you know, eventually if you do alleviate these restrictions, it really opens up the economy to do a lot of things, because what the interest rate restrictions really are is just a transaction cost. You have to take around some type of ruse to do this. So I show, for example, in this other work that what was by far the most important financial instrument in Europe in the medieval period, which was the bill of exchange, took on a very different role in Europe than in the Middle East. So essentially what the bill of exchange was like a check that you could send in one place and remit in another. And when you also remitted it, you had a different currency that you remitted it in. So what these bankers, you could call them bankers, did in Europe was that you could make a risk-free profit, more or less, by sitting at your home, sending a bill of exchange to one area, and then getting your money in the other area, and then buying another one and bringing it back. The reason you could make a risk-free profit is that exchange rates were different in different areas. So this was a way that it was a very easy way, and it was a very important way that people got around these things, and it led to a lot of long distance lending. And on the other hand, what you see in the Middle East is that this type of, and the bill of exchange was known in the Middle East prior to being known in Europe. It arguably came from the Middle East, and it never, but the Middle Eastern Bill of Exchange never takes on this kind of currency exchange aspect. And this is important because this is what allows you to make the risk-free profit. And the reason it doesn't is because of the ban on interest. So it's kind of in these subtle ways that, and it's really when you think about it, it's big business that gets crushed in a sense in the Middle East, because you know, it's one thing for me to lend you $100 by, you know, by doing this double sale. It's another thing for a bank to have to do this.
Uh-huh.
Right? And lend not just a lot of money to different people, but, you know, to a lot of different people. And that does require some type of transparency.
And that's why those larger investments, too, are critically important, because large investments allow you to do bigger things, take advantage of economies of scale,
exactly.
expand your markets, and that tends to lead to a virtuous spiral of capital accumulation.
And that's one of the, well, few, but, you know, one of the bigger things that you could argue is, you know, let Europe down this different path.
Yeah, we've talked to Tim McCran about some of the others, and we'll link to his podcast before, but the issue of primogeniture was an
sure.
interesting one that we talked about, but we won't talk about that here because we want folks to visit our other podcast. I really want to focus on the next critical piece of your puzzle, because as a political scientist, it's one that is near and dear to my heart. And you go about exploring the relationship between political and religious authority in these two regions, Europe and the Islamic Middle East. You focus a great deal on the extent that secular political rulers are dependent upon the religious legitimation of the clergy. So start off, and I'm going to let you dip into the political science realm here a little bit, and explain to me and our audience, what is legitimacy and why is that important for a political regime?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, political scientists and economists might have slightly different ways they think about this, but I think from my perspective and the broadly economist perspective, I think it's legitimacy is about, in a sense, belief. Belief from, you know, if you're talking about political legitimacy, it's about people's belief that that person has the right to do whatever the, you know, the premier in that region does. And it can also even be about belief in beliefs. And what I mean by this is that if I'm living in a dictatorship, I might not think that the ruler has a right to do what he's doing. But if I think everyone else thinks that, or they're not going to talk about it at the very least, then I view as what he's doing as at least that he has the right to do that. And what I'm talking about here is, or at least what the political authority might do once viewed as legitimate, is tax,
mm-hmm.
is set property rights, things that do affect others, right? And it's the belief that the political, and if we're talking about political legitimacy, that the political authority has the right to do that is what we're concerned with here.
Yeah, and it, I guess also from the side of the rulers as well, this issue of legitimacy, and I'm going to speak as an economist here, even though I'm a political scientist, it lowers the transaction costs for the rulers.
Sure.
Because they have to get people to obey the stuff. Okay, here's what the tax rate's going to be. Here's the property rights, who can do what, where, when, and how with their property. And you have to get people to obey those laws, and you're either going to have to force them to do it by having a big police force or army to monitor people and club them on the head, or you'll have to pay them off, and that chips away at any kind of residual that you can get from the society. Or if you just say, hey, do this because it's justly so.
Yep.
Again, people go, okay, then you don't need a big police force. You don't have to pay them off. That's kind of a good deal.
Sure.
Yeah. So what's so important about religious legitimacy?
Well, I guess in part it's what you just said. You know, there are multiple ways of being legitimate. One way is to have military backing, but as you just noted, that's really expensive. And the military can turn on you at any time. So religious legitimacy is, at least from a monetary standpoint, not expensive. But I think possibly even more, or probably even more importantly, is that, especially historically, religion has played a very strong focal point. It's something that, you know, whether you're in Europe, everyone's Christian, everyone goes to church every week, you're in the Middle East, everyone's going to the mosque on Friday. And in fact, you know, this is something, for example, the Ottoman rulers are very good at, was making sure that one of the very first prayers that was done was a prayer for the Sultan every Friday. So every Friday, everyone got to hear about from something, you know, from somebody that they trusted and believed in how great the Sultan was. It's a very nice way, and it's a very cheap way of getting the people to support you, to, you know, and then you can do whatever you want, more or less.
It definitely is the case, and in part because religious authorities, as well, people tend to trust them. And I've made this argument in some of my work before. Absolutely. That, you know, basing off of Iannacone's work where, you know, religions are credence good. So religious clergy have to work really hard to say, hey, trust us. Sure. And if you trust them and they say, trust that Sultan guy over there or trust this prince over here in this region, you go, oh, okay, well, if I trust my priest or my imam, then I therefore trust the next person. So there's a little bit of transference of that trust, I guess.
Sure, yeah. And they, you know, in both regions, and this is actually something that's important to my argument as well, they, you know, really most religions, the religious authorities take a whole lot of time to kind of convincing people, in a sense, that they have a monopoly over this good, and it is a credence good. It's, you know, this monopoly over eternal truths that are, you know, just not able to be had by others that aren't well versed in the religion.
Right, right, yeah. So what was the nature of this religious legitimacy for secular rulers in both medieval Christianity and the Islamic worlds, and how does this change over time?
Well, so maybe starting in the Islamic world, this is something that was always important, starting with Muhammad, more or less. So to even go slightly prior to the onset of Islam, when Muhammad was around, the Middle East was a place of tribal warfare. There was not a lot of social cohesion or political cohesion. And one of the reasons that, especially across the Arabian Peninsula and eventually well into North Africa, that Islam became so popular and spread so fast was that it did bring this type of cohesion, both politically, socially, everything like this. So essentially what happens is, you know, political authorities are dependent on this religion to legitimize what they're doing. And so what this means is, you know, that, you know, basic Islamic dictates need to be abided by, and so on. And this is something that is relaxed in time and place, and you know, to some extent, and the Ottomans certainly eventually relaxed this, but it's always been something that's very strong. And I mean, you can see, I mean, so Iran would be a great place to, you know, look at that today, and, you know, even, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, certain, at least in the more tribal areas, religion is a, you know, religious authority is extremely important. Now, in Christianity, this was something that ebbed and flowed. It was not something that was always part of Christianity. You know, Christianity was born in the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. And that's a minority religion, yeah.
Political institutions. And, you know, early Christian thinkers didn't even really think about this. So, and certainly, you know, by the time, you know, towards the end of the Roman Empire, you know, Constantine accepts Christianity and uses it to legitimize himself. But and despite the ebb and flow over time, this is it's never anything like in the Islamic world, the use of religious legitimization. This is something that is, so more or less the religious legitimization in Europe, I think most scholars would suggest, kind of peaked around the late 11th and early 12th centuries. This is around the time of Gregory the VII's reforms within the church to kind of really increase church power versus the state. It's the time of the investiture controversy, which greatly, at least for a brief period of time, increased church's power vis-a-vis the state. And then, not that long afterwards, which is something I think we'll get into, it starts to wane, and it starts to wane fairly fast. This idea, and by the end of the medieval period, I think you don't even really, you know, religious legitimacy is of secondary importance for sure.
Well, tell us why this is waning, because again, you make the argument that it really doesn't in the Islamic world, but in Christianity, you're saying here at the 12th century or so, you do start seeing the shift. So why is this shift going on?
Well, so in part, of, I mean, I think, you know, there's multiple reasons. The one that I point out, and I think amongst the most important, are economic ones. And this is actually, so you had mentioned that this paper that I written was on the, you know, on interest restrictions, and interest restrictions were important in their own right, but I view them more as kind of more symbolic of what's going on in the broader economy. And essentially what you see is that as commercial opportunities become greater, all of a sudden you now have political authorities that are caught in between two things. One is that they had relied to some extent on religious legitimization. On the other hand, there's this vastly increasing tax base that they have never had available to them before. Once it the tax base, and what we call the tax base, you know, just the commercial opportunities becomes big enough, they're not as dependent on religious legitimization in order to stay in charge.
Yeah, because I got a big bag of gold.
Yeah, exactly. they're willing to kind of at least relax some of these laws.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I point out laws on taking interest are a pretty obvious one that especially merchants would have a huge incentive to try to get relaxed. And they do this. And this kind of, this interacts, this goes back, there's kind of this loop, this cycle in a sense where, it goes back and forth between merchants and these political authorities. Cause as political authorities start allowing more and more of these things, commerce opens up even more. And all of a sudden you now have the religious authorities who look, in the church in Europe that kind of look like they're outdated. And eventually they reinterpret their doctrine, and this is what you see in amongst a number of commercial types of doctrine. And I should say this too. Just looking at restrictions on taking interest, this is not to say that the church was necessarily harmful for commerce. In fact, that is something that you had mentioned. Eklund and his co-authors point out is that the church certainly was an economic player in and of its own right, but there were certainly doctrine that did inhibit commerce.
Yeah, and in part, early in the medieval period, that the church was manipulating usury laws because it was both a borrower and a lender at various points in the European territory, and it manipulated those usury doctrines to their advantage to essentially be rent seekers in that regard. But as soon as that starts to slip from their hands, their ability to do that, and secular rulers also see this, I guess you would add a great deal more competition into the mix, and things start, I guess, to speak in economic terms, and you can correct me on this, but going down to their equilibrium level or their natural state level.
Very nicely done.
Oh, hey, cool. I get to qualify as an economist then. My question here is, why doesn't this go on in the Islamic world? Because you raised the question early in your paper here that, interest restrictions were initially stronger in Christianity, but then eventually became stricter in Islam. So what's happening there? And I'm curious in this regard too, because you're talking the 13th century becomes the unraveling of the Abbasid Caliphate. So this is when you're seeing a lot more political decentralization in the Middle East, North Africa. So why didn't we see the same thing here? In fact, why did they move in opposite directions?
So the way, the way this paper kind of looks at things is, the way an economist looks at things is you start by just assuming, kind of things are equal on both sides. You start by thinking, all right, let's say that commerce is at the same level on both sides. The one difference we want to say is, let's say there's a difference in legitimacy or the legitimizing relationship in the two regions. Let's just say that in the Islamic world that people or the political authorities rely on the religious authorities to a greater extent for legitimacy. Well, what happens? Well, when you have commerce starting to flourish, what you get is that merchants in both regions, because they start out by thinking that, all right, this is something that's banned by political and religious authorities, but I need to take interest because now there's all these opportunities. All right, so merchants start pushing the political authorities in both regions. The idea that this paper pushed forth, and as well as my work in general pushes forth, is that it just takes a small difference in this legitimizing relationship to have very big consequences. Because once the merchants push, what's happening in Europe is that these political authorities are kind of stuck between this place where they want to allow this larger tax base, but they do rely to some extent on religious legitimacy. But they don't rely that much, so they start allowing more and more things. And what we do see, at least with interest history, is that they quite quickly actually allow moderate interest. In fact, some places they allow interest up to 40-50%. This happens to a much lesser extent, though, if religious legitimacy is more important, because in this case, all of a sudden, what the political authority is doing is allowing something that is explicitly prohibited by the religious authority.
Mm-hmm.
And what that what the, so the bigger point here is that you have what could it, well in some instances was a small difference, and because of the cycle that happens, you know, it's kind of these merchants and political authorities kind of feeding off of each other, you get very, very different results. And you know, in the case of Europe, you get, you know, kind of more or less a complete dissolution of a lot of these religious ideas, and at least the economically inhibitive religious ideals. And in the Middle East, you know, to use the term you've already used, it's an equilibrium. It's an equilibrium to not really disallow too much or to allow too much. You know, and they allowed some, of course, and this is what the both political and religious authorities did allow, was these kind of evasions of the interest restrictions. But you never get, and in fact, interest is still prohibited, and you know, at least by strict adherence of Islam. And the Islamic banking system, in fact, is, you know, one of its key components is that it doesn't lend at interest, but gets around it in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the idea is that, you know, that the paths might have started out somewhat similar, or maybe even, and in fact, because commerce flourished earlier in the Middle East than it did in Europe, interest restrictions are actually, as you just noted, actually more relaxed in the Middle East than they were in Europe for quite some time. The types of ways of getting around the interest restrictions that you found, say, you know, around 1100-1200 in the Middle East were much more advanced than they were in Europe. But a large reason for that is that commerce was, you know, flowing much more quickly in the Middle East. But once you started getting this cycle in Europe between, you know, political authorities really supporting merchants in this sense, that's when Europe really started to push beyond the Middle East.
And it gets into that virtuous cycle where you can accumulate more capital. One thing that you don't do in this paper is speculate as to why the religious authority was so much more connected to political authority in the Islamic world. And you say you take that as an exogenous factor, meaning that it's something outside the realm of what you want to explain. But for me, as a political scientist, I'm kind of interested in why you think that was occurring, why political authority was so much more dependent upon religious authority. Can you give us some thoughts on that?
Sure. So this is kind of something I just talked about, where I think it really does come down to the origins of these religions. And that, you know, and to use the term you just used, I think, you know, can be viewed as exogenous, kind of outside the scope of what's happening 1,000 years later. In the sense, you know, Christianity was born in the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire had very well-functioning political and legal institutions, especially around the time of, you know, the first 100 or so years of Christianity. And what you really do see is that these early Christian thinkers are just not thinking in terms of the political, and it takes a long time before political authorities even start to view Christianity as something that's legitimizing, and that relationship is never solidified, whereas, you know, in the Middle East, this was something that happened immediately, and it was because of the social and political chaos that was happening prior to Islam being a cohesive thing. It was a unifying thing that brought together, you know, more or less from India to Morocco, in
right.
a sense. And because of this, this was something new that political authorities just had to adhere to in order to take advantage of this hugely unifying thing, and this is something, you know, a number of historians have pointed to, this was one of the things that did allow for these long distance caravans to really take off, was this kind of unifying the unifying political aspect brought on by Islam.
Yeah, we're all Muslims, so it's okay to trust one another.
Yeah.
And you can extend trade along that lines. You did mention that earlier, so I guess I should have been thinking of that. But as political scientists, we oftentimes need things repeated to us a couple of times, so is good.
But, so to another point, though, that you make here, though, is that I do kind of in this work also talk about how this kind of rise of commerce and how it kind of, you know, allowed for this virtuous cycle, did also kind of, endogenously, you know, kind of within the system, tear down even further the relationship between political and religious authorities, at least in the legitimizing relationship in Europe, because this was something where you did have this kind of, you know, political authorities moving way away from what the religious religious authorities wanted due to, you know, the rise of commerce. And you just don't see that in the Islamic world. And this is, you know, I argue it wasn't the only, but was one of the reasons why you see an even furthering, kind of delegitimizing of the relationship between the two.
Yeah. Now, it's really interesting to think about. And as you were talking about, too, it occurred to me, not only did Christians not think about the role of legitimizing political authority early in their history for the first 300 years or so, but, I mean, they were a minority religion that were being persecuted for. So for them to legitimate political authority, you'd say, well, that'd be crazy.
Sure.
Right? These people are feeding us to lions. What's going on here? We wouldn't want to do that. And that goes back to the whole render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar and yep. the God that is God. It's just, hey, don't bother me with this political stuff. We're not thinking about that. We're spreading the gospel. So I can see how that works. And then, you know, Constantine obviously changes that dynamic in the early 300s and it switches. But again, it's kind of built in that when commerce comes to the fore, political authorities just take back that legitimacy, saying we don't need the churches.
Yeah, that's the argument.
That much. Now, we got a few minutes left here, and I just want to ask you to give us a bit of a feature or a preview of some of the work you're doing in your book on the printing press. So we talked about interest here, and that's our main focus, but your book that you're working on focuses, you know, it's the title of it is God, Power, and Printing. So how does this all come into relationship with printing and stuff?
Sure. So I have some other work on printing, and this is, it actually is the same mechanism. And so the printing press was something that the Ottomans knew about for more or less three centuries before really allowing, at least allowing books to be printed in the Arabic script. Whereas in, you know, Europe, it was something that, at least by the standards of the time, spread relatively rapidly after it was invented around 1450 by Gutenberg. And the reasons given for this, and I have a few co-authors on this work, is that it was the same idea about religious legitimacy, and namely that it was the religious scholars in the Middle East that stood to lose a whole lot by the printing press being spread. Religious scholars had a monopoly on the oral transmission of the Quran, you know, and the monopoly on ideas in general. So they stood a whole lot to lose a whole lot. And what you see because of that is that they were fairly successful in having this technology being greatly, you know, well, not prohibited, but at least greatly regulated in the Ottoman Empire. And by the time of, you know, the 15th century, exactly the point, what we were just talking about, the church has lost a lot of this legitimizing power. And, you know, in Europe,
in
a factual world, might say maybe they would have wanted to have this, the printing press prohibited if they could have, because another thing I point to, and something that's been noted, is that, you know, the printing press was fairly instrumental in the Reformation, which was in many ways a huge blow to the church, kind of brought an end to, you know, this medieval period in a sense. And more broadly, you know, as now putting my economist hat on, you know, the printing press had huge implications for the European economy, more or less, starting, you know, in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. There's been some nice works recently showing that places with printing presses grew a lot faster. Commerce was a lot smoother in these areas.
It lowers the transaction cost of information and allows people to share ideas and to communicate ideas much more efficiently.
Exactly. And that's actually, you know, what the reformers and the Reformation did. You know, they sent out their pamphlets that, and in the types of numbers that were, it was just impossible to do, you know, 80 years prior. And in fact, you know, this is something, I think one of the most interesting things about that history is that you do see a lot of reformers prior to the printing press, like Jan Hus in the, you know, Czech Republic, that had very similar ideas to Luther, but they didn't have a printing press.
Yeah.
And
Jan Hus got burned, by the way, too.
He did get burned.
Yeah, so and that kind of slows down your ideas when you're, you know, at the stake and there's fire around you. But yeah.
Yeah, but his followers did hang on for a while, but they never got out of that, you know, their area. And in it is kind of amazing how once these ideas were able to spread, they kind of, you know, to go to kind of some of maybe Timur Kuran's other work, really kind of unleashed a lot of preferences that might have been falsified by a lot of people that were scared to say anything about the church. And, you know, just in general, the printing press has had, you know, it's, you know, arguably the most important invention of the last millennium, as far as, you know, just a whole host of implications. And, you know, and so the idea of this, you know, this book is to kind of show how, you know, especially these religious and political institutions kind of pushed these two economies on different paths. And I do think something that's important to note here is, all along, there's nothing inherent that I'm saying about the religions themselves or the kind of the
theological content
of the religions. It's much more about the institutions and how they interact with each other. Because, you know, even if you look at the actual doctrine, if you're going back to talking about usury, both religions ban usury.
Yep.
But it's kind of the way that over time these doctrines change that is kind of the real important stuff, I think.
Yeah, how they're enforced and how they regulate, which is really neat about your work and in general the economic perspective on religion. You know, a lot of times we just focus on the theological content, or scholars used to do that quite a bit. We never thought about the institutions very much, but they matter quite a bit. And I think that's really what the economic framework brings to the table for understanding a lot of this stuff, and your work is fascinating in this regard. And I think once you finish your book manuscript and get that thing published, we're going to come back and revisit the whole printing press idea. So I'm going to urge you to get off the phone here and start working on that so we can interview you again. And I'll be seeing you, you know, in a few months down to share a few waffle sandwiches. So
absolutely.
So Jared, it was great having you on Research on Religion today.
It was great being here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.